Well, we're going to be in Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. That's going to be in page 844 of your Black Pew Bibles. I did not bring show and tell, unfortunately. Mark, thanks for setting the bar high on that one. Now we're all going to be like, you know, extra stressed doing announcements. But I do have a question for you. As you guys are turning there to Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 38. Here's my question. So you guys know the Kit Kat logo of a Kit Kat candy bar. Just picture that in your head. Is there a hyphen between the Kit and the Kat? How many of you say yes? You can raise your hand. I'm seeing some. Okay, who says no? Wow. Okay, you guys got it right. You guys are good. Yeah, there is no hyphen between the Kit and the Kat. But if you see a logo with a hyphen in the middle, a lot of people will look at it and swear that hyphen was there the whole time. And you can do this with a lot of different logos where you just change one detail or make something very slightly different. And people will look at it and swear that that was there the whole time. That was original. And this is called the Mandela effect. And it's related to this passage today because this is often what happens to us, I think, in Scripture. It kind of becomes so familiar to us that we just skip past certain verses and passages without giving it much thought. So this is a passage you might be really familiar with, but I want you to pay attention because you might not be as familiar with it as you might think you are. So let's read this passage together. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist." And others say, "Elijah." And others say, "One of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does a man profit? What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." So this is a passage. If you've been a Christian for, you know, most of your life, or, you know, you've at least heard this passage on a number of occasions. And even if you haven't heard this passage, you might look at it and be like, okay, this seems pretty basic. Jesus is the Christ. He came to die for my sins and he rose again. I got it. Cool. But it might surprise you that you, like Peter, might be setting your mind on worldly things, on the things of man and not on the things of God. And we see this, Jesus repeats this prediction of his death and resurrection 3 times in the Gospel of Mark. In the next few chapters, he's going to say it over and over and over again. And you might be like, "Jesus, why do you keep repeating this? What's going on?" Well, the disciples seem to need to hear it because they still don't really get it when Jesus is eventually arrested, rejected by the religious leaders, crucified on the cross, and then rises again. They seem befuddled, like they didn't see this coming at all. And I can like read these passages of where Jesus predicts his death and resurrection and be like, "Okay, guys, come on. He literally said it. Like, what's going on?" The disciples aren't dumb. You know, they're not like hard of hearing. They're getting distracted. And Satan is like this. He works this way where you notice Jesus calls Peter Satan. And this is because Satan knows how to distract you from the gospel. He doesn't have to convince you that Jesus isn't the Christ. He's just got to add a hyphen in the gospel. He's just got to make a subtle change that you look at and be like, "Oh yeah, that looks close enough." And we get distracted. And Jesus is repeating this over and over again because he's saying, no. You got to go back to who do you say I am? So who do you say Jesus is? Because, you know, you're going to get distracted. And you need to keep reminding yourself of this, of who is Jesus? What did he come to do? And what does it mean to follow him? Because what you answer for who is Jesus, it trickles down. If you get that right, everything else falls into place. If you want to know how to live life rightly, look to Jesus. That's the answer. And so we're going to look at these three questions in turn and see how answering who Jesus is flows into what he came to do and what it means to live and follow Jesus the way he meant us to. So we're going to ask these three questions of who Jesus is, what he did, and what it means to follow him. We're going to get these answers that Jesus is the Christ. He came to suffer, die, and rise from the grave. And that finally following him means suffering and even possibly losing our lives because of him. So we're going to look at these in turn. So let's look first at verses 27 through 30. Who is Jesus? Jesus asks, like, who do you say that I am? And Peter gives a pretty straightforward answer. He's almost like a, you know, really eager school student. He's like, ooh, pick me. He says, you are the Christ. And he gets the answer right. And nowadays, that's kind of a church answer. You guys ever hear this? Like, if you get asked a question in adult ed or in, you know, Sunday school, you're in doubt, you don't know the answer, just say Jesus, right, or Christ. And that chances are I'll be right. We forget, though, that no one has called Jesus Christ yet in the Gospel of Mark. They've always called him teacher. So this is really significant. In fact, the only other place that the word Christ occurs before this in the Gospel of Mark is the first verse of Mark's Gospel, which says that the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So this is a turning point. This is the first time where Jesus, is understood to be the Christ. And the next time this term appears again is when the high priests and the religious leaders ask Jesus, are you the Christ? And he says, I am. And it's that moment where they sentence him to death for blasphemy. And they have the key evidence that he needs to be killed. So this term, the Christ, is really important in Mark's gospel. So what does it mean? What does that word mean, Christ? The word Christ is the Greek word equivalent of the Hebrew word Messiah. And some of you probably have heard the word Messiah before, but it specifically means anointed one, someone who's been sent on a mission. And this mission of the Messiah is to deliver God's people from bondage. This was, you know, thought to be kind of like a Moses figure, the way Moses delivered the Israelites from Egypt, similar kind of idea. But there would be a more permanent deliverance. All right. So the crowds, though, no one, you notice, like, Jesus asks his disciples, who do the people say that I am? And no one thinks that he's the Christ. It's really interesting, right? They all say he's a prophet, he's Elijah, maybe John the Baptist, who's come back from the dead. This is kind of odd. You know, why don't they think of him as the Christ? Well, because at that time, Jewish thought always thought of the Christ as this military figure who was, you know, going to come down and mean business, raise up an army, kick out the Romans, and establish a new kingdom that would last forever. That's the way they thought of it. Jesus, fair enough to the crowds, does not match that description at all. He doesn't fit that category. And so they call him a prophet. Well, everybody around Jesus really struggled to categorize him. He was kind of a hard guy to pin down. He didn't fit people's categories. And they all disagreed what category they should put him in. The Pharisees thought he was demon-possessed. They thought he was Satan. And his family thought he was crazy. He probably should go in a mental hospital or something like that. And the crowds think he's a prophet. It's a pretty broad spectrum of opinions, right? And he doesn't really fit any of these categories. He doesn't fit a lot of categories. He doesn't fit the category in modern terms of a social or political revolutionary. He's not holding up picket signs and, and practicing civil disobedience. He actually encourages his disciples and the crowds to pay their taxes, be good citizens. He encourages them to go beyond their civic duties of carrying the equipment of Roman soldiers, to carry it 2 miles, not just one. But neither is he a traditionalist. The Pharisees don't like Jesus, and they would be like the conservatives of their day. He's rejecting all these traditions that they prized and held with fervor, and he rejects all of that. Like, wait a minute, what? But then he's not a celebrity either. He's not just trying to get a huge following to get behind him. He kind of ignores the crowd for most of this passage. And he doesn't seem to care what people think about him. But then neither is he a hermit. He's not a monk. He's not like a recluse where he's just hiding out in the wilderness. He's always around people. He's healing people. He's teaching them. He's willing to cast out demons and to serve people in all sorts of ways. So it's hard to pin him down. What category do we put Jesus into? And you might, ask, if Jesus isn't fitting any of these categories, he doesn't seem to care what people think about him, why does he ask his disciples here and at this point in the gospel what people were saying about him? Why ask that question? Why does he care? He hasn't shown any interest in this question before this point. It's kind of weird. Well, I don't think that Jesus is all of a sudden getting self-conscious. I don't think he's insecure. I don't think he's like, are people saying good things about me behind my back? You know, he's not caring about that. He's not doing this, asking this question for himself. He is testing his disciples. He's trying to see if they get it. Because these crowds think that they are following Jesus, but they aren't. They don't understand who he is. They put him in the wrong category. And so he's contrasting, like, okay, that's who the crowds say I am, but who do you say that I am? Seeing if they give the same answer. And Peter catches on to what Jesus is saying, and he says, yeah, no, you're not a prophet. You are the Christ. And they get this because they've seen it, that Jesus is not just some prophet. He's not acting like John the Baptist did. He's not acting like Elijah did. He doesn't say, thus saith the Lord. He says, I say to you. He speaks with his own authority. He casts out demons with his own authority. He has authority over the wind and waves and the seas. On his own, he doesn't need to appeal to God's authority. He's not just a prophet. So they get this right. Their theology is right. Their doctrine is on target, we might say. But the truth that Jesus is the Christ is not just about right teaching. It's not just about, it's not just an abstract idea. We talked about how that truth trickles down into our lives. And John Calvin, is a famous theologian. He talks about this in his book, The Institutes. He, at the beginning of his book, he points out that you can't know who you are without knowing who God is first. That who God is informs who you are. And Jesus, being fully God and fully man, we can ask the same question of him. Who Jesus is informs who you are. The more you understand who Jesus is, the more you understand who you are and how you are to live. It trickles down. This question of who do we say Jesus is meant to be the focus of our attention. Because the more we focus on that, the more all the other questions we have about life fall into place. So the more you understand of who Jesus is and what he came to do, the more clarity you're going to have on what it means to live. Like how we're supposed to live. I think in our American context, we want a list of to-dos. We want a self-help plan. We want all these practical things you can put in place. And Jesus says, no, that's not going to quite do it. You need to just focus on me. Focus on who Jesus is. So let's talk about this. What did Jesus come to do? So look at the second question. We see this in verse 31 through 33. So we see that the disciples seem to understand who Jesus is. They get that he's not a prophet. They get that he's the Christ. But when Jesus starts explaining what he as the Christ has come to do, they start, flipping out. They don't understand what he's saying. Because he starts saying that the Christ, the Son of Man, has to be rejected, has to suffer, has to die a very painful and agonizing death on the cross and rise again. And keep in mind, the disciples still have this category of the Christ as a military general who's going to come and do battle and be victorious. And that doesn't match what Jesus is describing at all. And so you can see them just like, that doesn't make any sense. That's not what the Christ is supposed to do. What are you talking about? Jesus is breaking their categories. He's again, refusing to fit into their category of what they think the Messiah was supposed to do. And so Peter does something interesting here. He pulls Jesus aside and starts to correct him. Which is kind of funny because he just said that Jesus is the Messiah. It's like, you're going to correct the Messiah. That's cute. But, you know, he pulls him aside privately. And it seems like he's not trying to shame Jesus. He's not trying to challenge Jesus' authority. He's kind of pulling him aside and be like, hey, bud, I want to give you some advice here. He thinks he's helping Jesus. He's like, no, that's not what you came to do. We don't know what Peter said exactly. He doesn't say what his rebuke was, but it seems like Peter was offended that Jesus was saying he was going to come, suffer, and die. And that didn't fit what Peter thought in this worldly fashion that he was thinking. And that's exactly what Jesus rebukes him for. He says, you're thinking like you're putting your mind on the things of man. You're not thinking in God's terms. You're thinking in man's categories. You're not thinking in God's categories. He doesn't get that Jesus really is coming to deal with something far deeper than just Roman oppression. He's dealing with sin, the sin in our hearts, and death itself. I think in the church today, we can get really sidetracked. We're really good at being Peter. At least I know I am. We get focused on so much on how to respond to this or that thing happening in the world. You can get consumed by all the current events, being up on what new policies are being in place. There's all these controversial politicians in the world and these things that are happening that we feel this pressure as Christians. Like, how do we use the Bible to respond to all this? Like, what is a biblical response to this mean? Like, how should I think about these things? And it can feel pretty overwhelming. At least it can feel overwhelming to me. And I think the encouraging thing that Jesus has to say to you in this is that Jesus does not expect you to be a world expert. He doesn't expect you to be an expert in everything that's happening in the world and how to give a Christian response. These things are good. They're good to think about, but they're not the thing that Jesus came to do. We're called not to be world experts, but to be Jesus experts. That's what we're called to do. We're called to know Christ and to make him known. And we get distracted, I think, by these current events. They're important, don't get me wrong, but they can also become idols. So I want to do a thought experiment. Imagine if you were alive today, and Jesus, or imagine if Jesus was alive today. You are alive today if you're listening. Imagine, man. All right, and Jesus is walking beside you, and he tells you that to be the Messiah, to be the Christ, he needed to suffer and die a shameful death and then rise from the dead. How easy would it be to be Peter? Be like, whoa, Jesus, I don't see what that's going to accomplish. What you really need to do is go to Washington, D.C. and knock some sense in these crazy politicians that are just making all these terrible decisions, right? Like, that's what you need to do. That would fix everything. Or you might say, well, Jesus, no. You got to fix the church. The church is a mess. You just got to plant your own church. Show us how it's done, and then we'll all just do what you're doing, and everything will be good. Or you might even say, Jesus, like, get that you need to die for my sins. I believe that I'm a sinner. But first, before you die for my sins, could you please just go to the Congo, to Ukraine, and Israel, and just establish peace in those regions of the world? You could do it in a day, maybe less. It would be easy. Or maybe more closer to home, maybe it's like, okay, Jesus, I get that you have a mission. But before you go on that mission, could you fix my marriage? Could you fix my relationship with my kids? Could you fix my work-life balance? Could you fix my finances? Notice these things aren't bad, but if we're telling Jesus that these things are more important, if we're spending more time on these things than we are on the gospel, we're really saying to Jesus, Jesus, this is the problem that you really should have come to fix. This is what you really should have done. We need to watch this because we can spend more time spreading the gospel of our pet causes than we do spreading the gospel of Jesus. And what happens next should shock us. Jesus, he looks at Peter's sin and he confronts him and rebukes him and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Can you imagine if Jesus called you Satan? I wouldn't know how to respond to that, right? But Jesus is making a very profound point here that should, it's meant to be shocking. It's meant to make us like just, you know, not be able to speak, right? Because he's saying that sin makes us act like Satan. Peter is acting like Satan and trying to keep Jesus from going to the cross. It's exactly what Satan wants to do. And sin makes us do that too, without realizing it. And he can do this in subtle ways. He's just got to change our focus. Sin, without Christ, without grace in our lives, makes us Satanists. It makes you a follower of Satan. That's what Jesus is saying. You're either a follower of Christ or you're a follower of Satan. There's no in between. And that shocking statement is followed by an equally shocking statement, because Jesus, in saying that sin is that serious, doesn't say to Peter, get away. You're evil, you're wicked, you need to get away from here, and I never want to speak to you again. He says, get behind me. In other words, follow me. Don't follow Satan. You still got a lot to learn. You're following the way your sin has discipled you to act and to follow the devil in these ways. And I'm calling you to live differently. Your sin in following Satan doesn't convince Jesus to stop loving you. He still wants you to follow him. He still calls you to himself. And that's powerful. The depth of God's love for you, even while you're in league with the devil, even though you're dead set against him and his mission, he still loves you and wants you to follow him. He still calls you to himself. All right, so that leads us to this third point. What does it mean then to follow Jesus? We've looked at what it means to follow Satan. We got a pretty clear idea of what that looks like. What does it look like to follow Jesus? Jesus, you know, we've seen here, he breaks all these categories. He doesn't fit the boxes that people try and put him in, right? But he's also doing something else. He's creating his own category of Christ followers. And these Christ followers aren't going to work and operate the way the world operates. Every other worldview, every other, religion out there basically tells you, pursue your own happiness, reach enlightenment. Salvation is all about you and your spiritual health, your spiritual well-being. But Christ followers deny themselves. They don't try and pursue their own comfort and happiness and well-being. Instead, they pursue the happiness and well-being of others. And this should challenge us, because I don't know about you, but there's a lot of categories in this world that I feel really comfortable in. And so that's a challenge to you. What categories do you feel really comfortable fitting into? One of them is my age. I'm a millennial, you know, and I'm a bleeding heart millennial that is out there to make a difference in the world. And I judge everyone who thinks differently. I work, you know, with college students, you know, from younger generations that are thinking differently than I am. And they'll come off to me as like, man, these guys are lazy. They don't care about anything. Like, what the heck? Back in my day, I'll say stuff like that, right? And the Lord challenges me that I'm fitting that category way too comfortably, because I meet these Arcadia students. And when I get to know them, they are some incredible people. I just had a conversation with one girl she's 19. She's about to publish a book on the American Revolution before she's 20. It was not what I was thinking about when I was 19, let me tell you. there's some, you know, incredible people who break these categories. And I think the Lord is challenging you to think about what categories you fit too comfortably in and how he might challenge you to be less comfortable in that category. Because the category that we should ultimately fit in is Christ follower, a Christian. That's what we're called to be. That's meant to be our core identity. So, you know, we get to this point where Jesus, you know, if you want to follow him, it means being willing to suffer. He says this explicitly. You have to be willing to suffer and to lose your life for the sake of the gospel. And this is a warning that we got to take seriously, you know, because I think if you're like me, and if I were walking beside Jesus and Jesus was telling me this, I'd be like, whoa, Jesus, that's pretty intense. Like, I don't really like conflict. I'm not about confrontation. and all this stuff. Like, can't we just sit around and talk about theology? You know, like that sounds like a lot more fun. And Jesus, at least to me, maybe not to you, Jesus, you know, would say to me, get behind me, Satan. Because what Jesus is doing here is he's saying to the disciples, I love you too much to just sit around and be happy with this public ministry where I'm healing people and casting out demons and teaching you and where life is good. I love you literally to death. He loves you to the point of dying for you. And it's this radical love of Jesus where he says, I'm not going to love you halfway. I'm going to love you to death and back. That, you know, if we're going to follow Jesus, the call is to follow him in that radical love. We're not just suffering for suffering's sake. We're not just suffering to prove how faithful we are. We're suffering because we love Jesus. There is trust involved in suffering. Don't get me wrong. But the core here is this radical love that we're called to pursue. And, you know, Jesus, he's talking about a particular kind of suffering. He's not just talking about any kind of suffering. He's talking about persecution. And he's saying, because we don't fit in the categories of this world, the world's going to reject us. And we live in a fortunate time and place in history where, you know, we have the freedom to gather here to proclaim the gospel freely without fear of being arrested, without fear of being attacked and killed. But we forget that can you know, kind of deaden our senses. We forget that we live in a world where Christian persecution is actually at an all-time high. I mentioned the Congo earlier. The Democratic Republic of Congo is a war zone right now. And a few weeks ago, February 13th of this year, there was an attack on a town. Some insurgents went into this town, gathered up Christians in the town. They found about 70 of them. They brought them into a church. And they had every single one of them kneel down to pray. And they took out machetes. And as these Christians were praying, they beheaded every single one of them. And some of these were women and children. That scares me. Maybe it scares you. Maybe you hear that and that terrifies you, that you could go to a place like the Congo and find yourself killed for your faith. And I'm terrified if I am in that position that I could find myself denying Christ, that I could find myself just wanting to live. And maybe that's you too. And I just want to encourage you that fear is normal. Jesus is not calling you to literally feel no fear. Jesus is not calling you to be a stoic. If you've ever heard that term, the Greeks had a school of thought called stoicism, where you're called to just be completely detached emotionally, where you just don't feel pain, you don't feel suffering. That's not what Jesus is calling you to. He's not calling you to feel less. He's calling you to feel more. He's calling you to feel more love, not less pain. Jesus was not a stoic. He was in agony on the cross. He was terrified of dying. So why did he do it? He did it because he loved you. The way he felt love was deeper than his fear. That's what Jesus is saying. He's like, let your love be greater than fear. Perfect love casts out fear. That's what Scripture says. So I want to encourage you. Maybe you're here and you are terrified. Maybe you are not just terrified, maybe you are ashamed that you have hidden your identity in Christ. Maybe you have, you know, not told your coworkers or neighbors or friends or loved ones that you're a Christian. Maybe you feel like you've denied the faith. Maybe you feel like you've denied Christ instead of denying yourself. And I want to encourage you not to excuse that. It's serious. We all fall into that. I've fallen into that place where I felt like I've been timid and fearful, and I've let my fear overcome my love, and I've not shown Christ forth to other people. That happens. And if you're in that spot, I want to encourage you that Peter, he was the first one to affirm that Jesus is the Christ. He is also the first one to deny Christ. He did it not just once. not just twice. He denied Christ three times. And every time Jesus said, I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, but that when you come back to your senses, you will return to your brothers and comfort them. You will return to your faith. And so that's the encouragement to you. If you feel like you're in that position, it's not too late to repent. There is grace. Jesus' love for you is greater than your denial of him. Your sin that makes you follow Satan has no match for the love of the cross. And Jesus is calling you to himself. Even as you and I deny him, he is saying, I have accepted you. I have called you to myself. I choose you. That's what the gospel is. So the encouragement is to keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. Don't get distracted. Focus on who Jesus is. That will inform your whole life. That's the question. Who do you say Jesus is? That's what matters above all else.